All right. I will call this hearing of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is February 15th, 2024. Are we at quorum? All right. We do have a quorum present, despite the roads this morning. I know it was a little interesting even getting here from Roseville this morning. So the first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from our last meeting in last year. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 30th, 2023?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, Representative Feist moves the minutes of March 30th. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, minutes are approved. So we're going to start out today with a presentation from the Board of Public Defense. So we'll have a couple presentations from public defenders as well as civil legal services, and then we do have one bill that we'll be discussing today. But we managed to get a quorum here this morning.
Madam Chair and members, Kevin Kyer, Chief Administrator for the Board of Public Defense. With me is Bill Ward, the State Public Defender. To say that it was an adventure getting here this morning would be an understatement.
I thank you for being on time. Good job. We're always glad to have you here. Please go ahead with your presentation.
Sure. Madam Chair and members, you all have a handout there. I wasn't going to use the overhead. First of all, thank you all for the support over the last years, particularly last year. What you're going to see is really some what we've defined as really transformational for our agency, and it wouldn't have been done with the support of all of you and Madam Chair, your leadership on this issue and support. So. On the first page, just to go back from last year very quickly, is recruitment and retention, or page two. We came to you last year with the statistics that we had lost 37% of our attorney staff had resigned over the course of the 2019 to 2022. We had a 14% resignation rate in 2022, and our applications, as you can see, were down anywhere between 50 and 75%. On page three, you can see what the entry-level salaries for assistant public defenders was, and the 2022 entry level for the top 14 county attorney offices. Again, showing the difference of where we were last year compared to where we're going to show you where we are. So page four. Indicates where we are now on the bottom. We were able to raise the salaries, and obviously that was through a negotiation, a collective bargaining agreement, to entry level of just over $88,000 and a top of $158,500. So you can see that was quite a difference from where we were. The other thing that's important, excuse me, Madam Chair, and we talked about this last year, was we were able to move from a 17-step range down to 10. So we're able to keep those folks that have the experience, which was a huge, huge issue for us. What was happening a lot of times is we were getting folks in, they were getting some experience, and then after 3 or 4 years, they were leaving our office to go to just about anywhere, but in particular either prosecutor offices, city attorney offices, and the like. So I will note that on that scale, because I know all of you have probably seen the article in the Star Tribune about the county attorney salaries. I have no doubt that the county attorneys will catch up. We've had some indications that that's already the case. I know St. Louis County has up their salaries for their county attorneys. I know we just had an individual we were going to hire up in our Brainerd office out of a prosecutor's office down here, and his office matched our salary. So he decided that rather than move his family from the metro area to Brainerd, he was going to stay where he was. So, but it's important to know, too, is that because of the way the money was allocated, we don't have any increases again until July 1st of 2025 at the earliest. That was negotiated as part of the collective bargaining agreement to move the salaries up, and they are significantly higher, and reduce those steps, but not have increases the next fiscal year. So on page five, you can see again, the scales, the actual scales for our attorneys, where it was and where it went, the column on the left, obviously the previous scale. Our support staff, which was another big piece. You can see, again, we were able to, on page 6, reduce the number of steps generally from 16 down to 9. The increases for our support staff followed pretty much along the lines of what the attorneys received. And that's been a really important issue for us, because we were having the same kinds of issues relative to attracting people and keeping them. And they're so integral to what our folks do. And when you get good support staff, good investigators, good paralegals, those of you that practice, you know how valuable those people are. So, results. You saw this slide last year on page 6, I guess it is, public defender resignations. You can see that we had 40 of them in 2023. We had 77 in 2022. Between August, or I should say July 1st of 23, and when this was put together, I think we based it on through the end of the calendar year, we had 6 resignations statewide, and only 2 folks that left for other public agencies. So it has helped. It has definitely helped. We've had a couple of resignations since then, but it has stabilized what we are doing tremendously. The other piece is, in terms of recruitment, we've been able to recruit people with experience. As I mentioned, you all saw the county attorney article. The majority of those folks were actually folks that used to work for us, and they couldn't afford to do it anymore, but they love the work. They love doing what representing clients, and they were able to come back and work for us, which is a godsend. Again, those of you who do this work or who practice, somebody that has experience and can step right in and take a felony caseload or take a high misdemeanor caseload is unbelievably important. And the morale for the folks that are in the office, it's incredible that somebody can step in and start right away. So on the next page, staffing. We did hold off on recruiting and staffing because we wanted to be able to go out with the new salary ranges, obviously, and that didn't get done until about the end of August. We have been able to add 70 full-time equivalents to our attorney staff. We gave the first option to our part-timers to convert from part-time to full-time where they wanted to do it, and frankly, where our chiefs wanted to do that. We've hired 43 assistant new public defenders. 16 managing attorneys to date. I think we've got 2 or 3 more to fill. I think we talked to you last year about the fact that these managing attorneys were carrying a full caseload and trying to supervise and mentor and second chair for 25 lawyers. And that's just not possible. It's just not, they can't do a good job with that. So, and also added some of the support staff. So, it has been we would say very successful, we are, as I said, very appreciative. The big issue actually going forward, it will continue to be, if you look on page 9, is the workload, right? We've talked to you all about this before. You know, our caseload standards were developed in 1991 prior to any audio or video or remote hearings, DNA, any of those kinds of things. If you turn to the last page, or the second to last page, I should say, the National Public Defender Caseload Study just came out. It was done by the RAND Corporation, National Center for State Courts, and a panel of defense lawyers from across the country. And the number for the standard are significantly lower than what we have. If you look at that last page, our felony standard is 150 cases a year. Even for a low felony, the maximum that they are recommending is 59 felony cases a year. Our misdemeanor standard is 400. The maximum they're talking about is 150. So we have some work to do. We have some work to do in terms of getting those numbers down. We're improving, but we're nowhere close to this. Our job, frankly, with our board over the next several months is going to be looking at the studies that this group looked at, look at the national study that they put together and determine what works for Minnesota, right? What works for us? Because again, that standard is now 33 years old, and it just doesn't reflect reality anymore. So we are very appreciative of, again, the support that you all have given us. Again, Madam Chair, your leadership on this. It has been a game changer. There's no question about it. And our job now is to maintain it and to keep moving forward with it. So thank you. And obviously stand for any questions that anybody has.
Yeah, so on the caseloads, because it's funny, two of the things I'd written down as you were talking, like the next slide actually got to the answer. So one thing I was going to lift up is I know I've heard anecdotally from folks that there are a significant number of folks who had originally been public defenders who left because, you know, they were just offered salaries that they couldn't turn down on the prosecution side and are now coming back. So I think some of the sort of people being upset about it, I think, it makes sense. We want all of everybody in the system to be paid what they need to be paid to get the job done and to do the work. We need good people on both sides. And I will also lift up, I think, you know, in my conversations with folks, with county attorneys and public defenders and people who've worked in both sides, too, I think sometimes from the outside, we think that the kind of person who does that work is a very different type of person, and the reality is that sometimes this is someone who wants to work in public service and public law and you know, is able to sort of argue either side and represent their client well. You know, that's what being an attorney is being able to represent your client well. And I think that sort of antagonistic you know, us versus them thing, I think when you're actually working in the courtroom is not necessarily the reality. On the caseloads, you know, what are your thoughts about, you know, now that we've sort of have staffed up, that we've got some folks who are part-time or contract now as full-time, you know, do you think with now that we're staffed up and getting, you know, qualified people back into the work, do you think some of that caseload will be impacted by that? Or, you know, what are you thinking right now as far as how that's going to impact those caseloads moving forward now that we've got more staff doing the work?
Madam Chair, and Bill may want to chime in also, is that there's no question that it's been impactful in a good way, right? As I said, people that can step right in the door and take a full caseload from day one is just, the value of that is just, you can't sit here and tell you how valuable that is. On the other hand, we do know we have to start doing a better job of recruiting also in the law schools, right? Because we are top heavy in terms of, I shouldn't say we're top heavy, we're senior heavy in terms of our staff, right? We have a lot of people who are at the top of the pay scale. We have a lot of people who are baby boomers, and they're going to start retiring, and they have started retiring. Our frankly, one of our big issues right now is, and we were just visiting with the folks from Civil Legal because they're experiencing the same thing, is we can't find any lawyers in the 9th District, the 7th District, more rural parts of the state. And that's just not us. That's a phenomenon nationwide. You know, I know from other public defender organizations we talk with, that's a big issue. The 9th District, there just aren't any lawyers, right? And, you know, we've got to do a better job of outreach to attract people. And I think where we have to do that is in the law schools, right? We're not going to get people necessarily to move from the Twin Cities and uproot their family and move. You know, it's the same issue that you all have heard with the doctors, dentists, veterinarians, those kind of professions. So we've got it, and we are. We're doing better outreach. We got it, but we've got to do that.
Well, Madam Chair, if I may, Bill Ward, State Public Defender. We continue to meet and confer with the union on this issue as well, and this and other issues. And anecdotally, they are telling us that they're seeing more cases being appointed to our agency that they believe do not qualify. Meeting with the chiefs tomorrow, we will discuss again having brown bag lunches with the district court judges. You have a lot of new judges. I don't know how they're being trained as to who's eligible and who's not. So it's certainly worth having these discussions again with not just the district chiefs but all the judges. And it's an issue that has always concerned us, and I believe the courts have done historically a good job, but it sounds like it's going back into a direction where we're getting cases we shouldn't be appointed to. The other issue that we're grappling with internally is making sure that there's even case distribution. So we had a long discussion regarding how are cases assigned? You know, what is the assignment process? Again, chief's meeting tomorrow. I already have a lot of the information from the chiefs and some of the districts as far as is it a pickup week, right? Hennepin County uses pickup days for felonies, for instance. Some counties use pickup weeks. What system's being applied? Do people see how it's being applied? Is there transparency? And if, in fact, there's a concern regarding their caseload, what avenue do we have internally to address what the cases are and making sure they're evenly distributed?
Yeah, and I will say, as someone who was born and raised in the Ninth, it's a great place to live.
That's what we hear.
Yeah. You could go fishing right after work. Right. You could sit in the deer stand before you go to work.
And our folks do, Madam.
I know they do. Yeah. Well, and I know talking to judicial branch too that's been a problem there, even with the applications for open positions for both judges and staff in the Ninth. You know, and I think that's something across this committee we're going to have to, with the accounts that we're in charge of, something we all need to be thinking about. So that's super helpful. Members, any questions? Yeah. Vice Chair Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Couple of questions. One, do we have a percentage of how many folks are near retirement age?
Whichever one of you wants to take it.
Madam Chair and Representative Frazier, I don't right off the top of my head. I could get it for you. I know the last time we looked, I think we had about 30 or 35% of our staff was at the top of the pay scale. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean they're near retirement, but and we do have, I will tell you this, we have an early retirement incentive that is put in a long time ago and was sunset a long time ago, but I think there are at least 50 lawyers on that list, if you will, and I don't know how many that we've hired since that. So we can certainly get that to you.
Okay. Madam Chair, what do you mean by retirement age? 59, 62?
Well, whatever you all consider what folks may be getting close to, I didn't have a number.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll put something together.
Okay.
Yeah.
Be helpful.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned that, Madam Chair.
Yeah, go ahead.
And you mentioned that you're not going to do any salary increases until 2025, which was negotiated, but that's exclusive of COLAs, right? COLAs are, cost of living increases are, that also includes cost of living increase.
Yeah, and Chair Representative Frazier, there are no, that what was negotiated was no increase the second year of the biennium. So
okay.
We will obviously, after next session, start the collective bargaining process again. So,
Vice Chair Frazier.
And so with the recruitment piece, you all still have the internship programs that you do with the law schools?
Absolutely.
Okay. Yep. Now, how are those going?
Madam Chair and Representative Frazier, they're going really well. We have hired an HR manager to coordinate our efforts, and what we've done is she's taken that role on, and we've reaching out past the law schools in Minnesota. Frankly, we got to do a better job of diversifying our workforce, right? We have to have it reflect better what our client base is, and she's doing that. We had a couple of folks that went out to Ohio State. We had a couple that went to Michigan just in the last 30 or 60 days. And we're doing a better job of getting out. We got to go beyond the law schools here. We just have to. As all of you know, it's a tough process, right? It's difficult, but we got to do it.
Hopefully, that Star Tribune article is helping get the word out as well. I know I teach a class at Mitchell Hamlin, and I always remind my students that there are decent paying jobs in the public sector if they choose to go that route. Any additional follow-up, Vice Chair Frazier?
Mr. Ward, do you want to say something?
Mr. Ward.
We've also developed a stipend for law students, which is huge. I've developed a relationship now with the Black Public Defender Association, which is part of NLADA, and we're going to get an internship from that program this summer. They're going to be here with their annual meetings. Going to be in Minneapolis this summer, we learned, so we'll have some more discussions with them there. So that's a big a coup for us as well.
Anything else?
One more question. You said, who's the coordinator again of the outreach and recruitment program?
Mr. Kier.
Madam Chair, Representative Frazier, our HR manager, Bree Scott.
Okay. And are they developing relationships with HBCUs or POC?
Yep.
Okay.
That was one of the first things she did.
Yep.
Okay.
So.
All right. Great.
Very good. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Thank you. Any additional questions? All right.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. It's good you didn't tell me that you needed any more money.
That's next time. Next time.
And if the folks from Civil Legal want to come on up. Yeah, well, they're getting set up. We do have one new staff person. Harry, if you want to introduce yourself to the committee.
Hello, everybody. Harry Kennedy, GOP caucus. Been here a long time and have never served with the Civil Law Committee and excited to do so.
Nice.
Welcome.
To
yeah, not new to the work, but new to maybe this committee. And I will note, too, for folks who maybe didn't see the emails, typically we've had Ben Johnson and sometimes Jeff Diebel sitting in from House Research, but Mr. Diebel was called up to National Guard duty, and so Ben Johnson has got to carry some extra weight in the public safety space. So we will have Mary and Nathan here on a regular basis as our primary researchers this year. So, all right, are we ready? All right, please introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Chair Becker Finn, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Dori Rappaport. I'm the executive director of Justice North, formerly known as Legal Aid Service of Northeastern Minnesota. I'm here on behalf of Civil Legal Services, and I just want to start by saying thank you. Thank you so much. This has been monumental for Civil Legal Services. I was just talking to our colleagues at the Public Defender's Office, and I said, this is the first time when I've offered somebody a position, I haven't had to get to that salary part and cringe before I have to tell them what we would be able to pay them. Now we know that we are actually giving living wages to people doing critical life-saving work. It's just been tremendous. So thank you. Thank you so very much. Today we are going to hear from a number of representatives of Civil Legal Services. So you'll be hearing from Ann Hefgen. She's the executive director of Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota. Dan Morris, he is the executive director of Central Minnesota Legal Services. Jessie Nicholson, she's the CEO of Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services. And Jess Fonts, she's a staff attorney with Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota. I am the person that will talk to you about the data, and my colleagues will talk to you about the impact. And so we've seen tremendous increases again in our salaries. When we came to you and asked for the increase last session, the focus was salary parity and capacity building. And we started by working on salary parity. So you can see in the slide before you, we use our staff attorney starting salary as a benchmark. And when we're talking about salary parity, we're talking about all staff at Civil Legal Services. This just gives you a point of reference to know where we've been and where we're going. So you can see in 2020, our starting salaries across the board on average for staff attorneys was $50,774. We were able to move that dial in 2022 to $56,362. But after this tremendous increase, we now, as a system on average, by the end of 2023, starting salaries are up to $68,686, which is huge. And we are still working on salary parity for this next fiscal year. And so, as we told you when we were before you last time, our goal is to get to an average starting salary of $80,000 for staff attorneys. As you heard from the public defender previously, you can see where they have moved to, and we're still trailing behind you a bit. But it does make us more competitive in the public sector, and we're not so incredibly far behind the starting salaries of our other public sector colleagues. So again, thank you for that. We have started working on capacity building. So you can see on this slide and sort of the green arrow under the 2023, we were able to add 43.75 FTE, and that's since March of 2023. And I know a number of the civil legal services programs are planning on really shifting this year to looking at how we can continue to increase our capacity. And so there are some organizations that have actually worked with their boards to implement capacity building plans that they're planning on rolling out this next year. I remember when I was here last talking about the turnover rate for civil legal services. So just a reminder, in 2021, I mean, we were really bleeding. 37% for turnover was just horrible. Every time somebody turned over, less and less people were getting help. And so the improvement has been great. I mean, 20% is still, it's still higher than we want it to be. But I think when we come back to you again next session, I'm really hoping that number will be down. But 20% has been a game changer for us. And you know, that's the theme I think of today, is that this has really been a game changer. So I'm going to take pause here and let my colleagues come and talk to you about the impact. So I think we're going to start first with Ann Hefkin.
All right, welcome to the committee. And thank you for sharing that information, and those slides are super helpful. Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Ann Hefkin. I am the Executive Director of Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota. I have dedicated my career to civil legal aid. I just celebrated 20 years. I'm getting all emotional, you guys. We've said the word game-changing and transformational, and it is absolutely true. The last year has been an experience that I've just, it's been a pleasure. It's been amazing. And so thank you. The impact it has had on our hiring experience can't be understated. We spoke earlier, the public defender spoke earlier about the 9th district, and I have an office in Bemidji, and there was an open attorney position from 2020 that I posted multiple times with zero applicants. And I've finally been able to fill that position. And I took someone from private practice in the Twin Cities, and he moved up to Bemidji to, I don't know if he's a hunter, but he's an outdoorsy kind of guy. So I found the right person for this role, and it's been amazing.
Need to make a little commercial.
Yeah, exactly. Bemidji. It's lovely in Bemidji. I am still hiring in Bemidji if you know someone who would like to work there. So the pool of candidates for every position has been a broader pool of candidates. It's been a more diverse pool of candidates, both for the attorneys. I was even able to hire an attorney in Fergus Falls away from the county attorney's office. She did take a pay cut, but it was a rational pay cut that she made to go back into practice family law and work in domestic violence, an area that she worked in before she went to the county attorney's office. And bringing in an experienced attorney, Mr. Kyer talked about that, has been amazing. Someone who can start hitting the ground running, doing those really hard, life-saving, changing cases of domestic violence. On the support staff side, the same. We're offering a living wage now. We have an intake worker position open, and we have literally gotten dozens of applicants, high-quality applicants. It's a game-changer. I'm going to keep saying that word. I have an intake worker who about a year ago was going through some family situation, so she left our office. She was sad to leave. She liked the work. She cares about our clients. She called me a couple of months ago and said, is there any way I could come back? I don't know if I can make it work. And I was able to offer her a significant increase in a compensation package that she, as a single mom of three kids, can afford to take. For many years, we had staff members that qualified for our services, that qualified for public benefits. And that was not okay. And thanks to this committee, Madam Chair, your leadership, and to the legislature for those increases, it has changed the work that we do. And I think, truly believe that our clients, the most vulnerable in Minnesota, deserve the highest quality of services at every level of the organization, and we're offering them that now. So that's all I have to say. Thank you. Yeah,
thank you. Next on my list, I have Dan Morris. Please introduce yourself. Welcome to the committee, and then go ahead with your testimony.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dan Morris. I'm the Executive Director of Central Minnesota Legal Services. I've been in the position about 5 months or so. Prior to that, I was a managing attorney for Central Minnesota Legal Services in the St. Cloud area. So supervising St. Cloud and Wilmer, part of the rural parts of our office that we provide. And I just want to kind of expand and reiterate what Ann has already kind of testified to. You know, these, and as Dory has mentioned, you know, these salary increases are not, while we kind of use the benchmark for staff attorneys and the goal of what we're looking at, these are salary improvements for all staff too. So paralegals, support staff, even supervising attorneys. And what we're really seeing, the impact of the funding is increasing the quality and quantity of services that we're able to provide at Central Minnesota Legal Services. So for supervisors, you know, it's still early, but we've been able to retain a lot of supervisors. One of the things that I've noticed in legal aid is a lot of times supervisors kind of win that game of survival where they're there the longest, but we're able to recruit and hire experienced attorneys from outside the organization that can bring fresh perspectives in, new ideas, new energy, you know, and even those staff that are becoming supervisors really develop and help train them into very quality supervisors. I know that Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid wasn't able to be here this morning, but in talking with them, you know, and we kind of cover the same service area, they've added 6 supervisor positions based on this funding. So that means more mentorship and training of newer attorneys, more time for supervisors to focus on some of the administrative work that we have. And it's really created a more supportive, experienced, healthier office. We at CMLS have created a supervising paralegal position for the first time to help support our paralegal team as well. So, you know, on the attorney side, you know, people are talking about larger applicant pools. We're seeing that. Ann testified to having 0 applicants in the St. Cloud office. There was a time there between 2021, 2022 where we had open position, went through 4 rounds of hiring. We'd hire somebody, they'd be there 2 months and leave, get no applications the next time. The next person was there 3 months and left, and then hired again and no applications again. That position's now filled, and we're getting a lot of applicants for those open positions. Those applicants, too, are more experienced. It takes less time training on the substantive areas of law. We're able to put them to work right away, taking new cases right away. And that's really, I think, all of this that we've seen in improvements for supervisors and staff and attorneys relates to a better client experience for people that are engaging with civil legal services. There's more trust there, I can see. I looked at the number of grievances our office has handled at the executive director level over the years, and in the previous years, it would be about 10 to 12 a year. This last year, it was 2. So people have that are engaging civil legal services for representation are more trusting in their attorneys. You know, at CMLS, we're primarily a family law law firm. Those cases can take 1 year, 2 years, sometimes 3 years. And it wouldn't be unusual to have 2-3 different attorneys assigned because of the turnover. And now we're seeing attorneys, family law attorneys, staying on the case from beginning to end. There's more rapport with clients. There's more trust with clients. It's resulting in more resolutions, better use, efficient use of our resources at Civil Legal Services, but also the judicial resources as well. But if there are things that do need to be litigated and contested, we're seeing that, you know, bringing in an experienced supervisor and other experienced attorneys are having better outcomes for clients as well. Yeah, and I think just the last point I want to make too is, you know, it's given us the space to be a little creative in how we use these resources too. At CMLS over the last year or so, we've created a hotline so that staff attorneys can dedicate full time to full representation. You know, there's more specialization in cases, so we're building our experience up, and again, the efficiencies and ability to help clients more effectively and efficiently we're seeing through a lot of this increased funding. So I just wanted to thank, you know, the legislature, this committee, Madam Chair, for all of your support and the funding, and you know, it's really, again, been transformational for our programs, and I'm really excited to see what we can do in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list, I have Jesse Nicholson. then I have Jess Fonts next. And if you want to come sit in the chairs up here closer to the testifier table, you're welcome to when you're on deck.
Good morning. Can you hear me or not?
I can. Good to see you again. Please introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Beckerfin and committee members. My name is Jesse Nicholson, and I'm the CEO of Southern Minnesota Regional Legal Services, headquartered here in St. Paul. We have offices throughout the 33 counties of Southern Minnesota, keeping us busy. I wanted to just comment about and to thank you, first of all, for supporting us with this historic increase from last session. But I wanted to comment on one specific thing that's happened at Smurls. We have had obviously seen an increase in all of our practice areas, but one practice area in particular was in consumer law. The pandemic brought out the worst in people in terms of consumer law issues. And so our board began to look at that and said to itself, we need to establish a freestanding consumer law unit. And so what that meant was that we looked at some statistics from January of 2022 to January of 2023. We had 571 requests for consumer law issues. 304 of those calls were seeking assistance with collection, repossessions, and garnishments. 60 of those callers were seeking bankruptcy and debt relief. And you can imagine why, you know, with the pandemic and all everything that happened economically for all of us during that period, not to the exclusion of low-income people. So we started a consumer law practice unit with two lawyers, one of whom came from private practice, highly experienced in bankruptcy and other consumer law issues, a 20-some-year lawyer that came to Swirls. We were able to hire that person because of the salary increase that we're able to provide. Our starting salary for newer lawyers before this increase was $58,600. $58,600. Our starting salaries now are at $74,000, over $74,000. And this highly experienced lawyer coming to head the consumer law unit, you can imagine what his salary increase was. And so that's been extremely useful. We're now in the process of hiring a third consumer law lawyer to be housed in our Rochester office, and we're getting it's a ton of applicants for that position. Needless to say, consumer law issues go across the board and throughout Southern Minnesota, our service area. I wanted to also say that what we're doing now is to be looking at hiring three social workers, one in each area of Smurls, the service area, one in the metro region, one down in the southeast region in Rochester, and then one down in the Mankato area where we have an office down there. Social workers are critical because they can help do some of that social worker work that lawyers currently are doing. We need the lawyers to be able to use their licenses and lawyer on the cases. And so we're adding positions like that. Smurls' board has adopted a full-fledged capacity building plan, a document that actually sets forth everything we want to try to do in the next year. And so I wanted to just say, to give you that as an example and to thank you for your support. It's so meant so much to us as we continue to serve low-income people in Southern Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Last, I have Jess Fonts. And correct me if I'm saying your name wrong. Welcome to the committee, and please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, and you got it right. My name is Jess Fonts. I'm a staff attorney at Legal Services of Northwest Minnesota, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about my experience and how these changes in funding has affected me. I worked as an intake specialist at Montana Legal Services before I went to law school, and it was really my first introduction to the world of legal services, and I met attorneys there that I really looked up to, and I was like, this is the kind of thing I want to do. So it's kind of what prompted me to go to law school. But Montana Legal Services was a really underfunded organization at the time. They covered the entire state, so they had to make hard decisions and really prioritized advice calls, didn't do a lot of extended representation, and the starting salary for attorneys was $40,000 a year at the time in 2016. So I went to law school knowing I wanted to do public interest. I wasn't sure exactly what I wanted to do. I really liked the idea of legal services, but I knew that $40,000 a year just wouldn't be something that would be doable for me with student loans and that sort of thing. So After law school, I started working as a public defender, actually, in another state, and I really loved the work. Can't speak more highly for public defenders. But last summer, I moved back to my home state of Minnesota and decided to apply for a legal services job. And after my interview, I was really excited at the prospect of doing housing court, which was kind of similar to my job as a public defender. And just the organization and the job seemed like a really great fit for me. And when I was offered the job and given the salary, I was very pleasantly surprised. It was about $20,000 more a year than I had been making as a public defender in Alabama. So in my relatively short time at LSNM, I've learned that having adequate funding makes such a huge difference in the quality of representation that I can provide to clients. I have time to dig into some complicated issues, compelling cases, spending time that each client really does deserve when they talk to us, whether that's a brief advice call when they call into our helpline or if it's a more extended services case. And I have time to do trainings and learn about the areas of law that I wasn't familiar with coming from a criminal defense background. And also having a livable wage has been a huge change for me in my quality of life. It helps with my own mental health. It makes the work so much more sustainable, and it really does allow me to show up as my best self for my clients. So thank you so much, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And I know, too, you know, we're talking a lot about the salary number because it's the thing we can kind of control and measure. But I think I'm glad we had a staff attorney testify as well, because at the end of the day, you know, the goal wasn't just to get people to be paid more, but to make sure that we have a functional system so that how much money a person has doesn't impact their ability to have good representation in the courtroom. So I thank everyone who testified today. Members, do we have any questions for legal aid? Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to say there are some days when this job is, many days actually, where this job is pretty incredible. And I think this is one of those days, hearing that the impact to working people, the decisions we've made about our budget, the impact that has. And that's really a credit to you, Madam Chair, and your work trying to make sure that we're fully funding our public defenders. And Lead Scott and our colleagues on the other side, you've been supportive of that as well. So I just wanted to point that out. And of course, the work you did for getting every last dime for civil legal services, it paid off. And just wanted to recognize that. But I actually do have a question. And it's been a long time since I was in law school, and I don't know what kind of loan forgiveness or loan repayment there is for people who choose public sector work for law school loans, and I'm just kind of curious what that might be.
Ms. Rappaport.
Chair Becker-Finn, Representative Mueller, thank you for the question. You know, there are multiple options. So there has been the public service loan forgiveness option, which has changed a bit over the course of the last few years and actually expanded. I can say I am one person who had my student loans forgiven, and it was one of the best days of my life, quite honestly. So I know that within our state, we have LRAP that helps with loan forgiveness as well, and work in tandem to ensure that the threshold for loan forgiveness is reflecting the increases in salaries. And so those opportunities are told to civil legal services staff generally when they're hired, that this is something that should be on their radar, planning for public loan forgiveness options and also knowing what is available within the state.
And I know, too, it's 10 years, so, and you have to be making the payments on time for the whole 10 years. So for folks who are like, oh, they also give the, it's not simple. And it is often a highlight for a lot of folks when they finally meet that point. Any follow-up, Representative Mueller? All right. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. It's good to be back. I had just one question, and I probably think I already know the answer to it. But before I get to the question, I just want to say
Yes, we allocated the money last year that was needed and had been, in the past had been largely ignored. And so I'm happy for that. But I don't want to leave this room without saying thank you to the taxpayers, because they're ultimately the ones that are footing the bill for this. And it is, you know, whether it's the public defenders or whatever, it is part of our system of justice here in the state of Minnesota, and it should be funded. But the real credit goes to the taxpayers of Minnesota. We came to an agreement on the number for that, but that's who the credit ultimately goes to. And I know, Madam Chair, this is a kind of an off year, just a sort of mini update. But I think you folks, Ms. Rappaport, you keep data on the types of cases that you take on. And then do you also keep data on the outcomes of the cases?
Ms. Rappaport. Madam Chair, Representative Scott, thank you for the question. And you are correct. So we have data that we keep on case types, and we also have data on outcomes. Right now, the civil legal services programs are reporting outcomes for full representation cases. But we actually, LSAC, the Legal Services Advisory Committee, actually brought in a national consultant that's been working with the majority of the grantees on reviewing our data so we can look at improving how we are tracking those outcomes. And so that's something we're actually in the process of doing right now. And it's been an incredible opportunity to really dig in. And so I think next session we'll be able to share some more information about some of these outcomes. I don't think they'll be fully implemented by then, but we'll certainly have progress made on what we're starting to collect as a system.
Representative Scott. Thank you, Madam Chair. So do you compile that data annually? I guess I'm just interested in getting my hands on it on the most recent, maybe couple of years to do some comparison. Is that something you do annually, or is that just by the budget year, like every 2 years?
Ms. Rappaport. Madam Chair, Representative Scott. Yes, it's annual. And so the numbers that we'll be looking at from 2023, that data reporting is due by March 15th. So we will have information after that, and we'd be happy to provide a comparison of what the numbers look like for cases closed, case types closed, and what we're currently collecting for outcomes, if that would be helpful.
Yeah, Representative Scott. Thanks, Madam Chair. Yeah, I would like to see that data for sure. Yep, thank you.
And I'll just note too, I think sometimes in the legal process, the most just outcome doesn't necessarily leave either side feeling like they've won. So, you know, it's not like sports where we can say statistically we had more wins because we invested in better players. You know, in a custody proceeding, the most fair outcome, each party might walk away not being entirely happy with the proceeding, even though that was the most just compromise that could have been reached. So I'll just note that I recognize that, especially in the civil case and even in our criminal system, you know, it isn't always about wins and losses. It's about the most just outcome for everybody involved. So we will look forward to that information when you have it. I don't have any other questions on the list, so I thank you very much. I thank the testifiers for traveling to be here in person. We certainly appreciate you being here and appreciate all the work that you all do across the state of Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. And we have a bill. All right. Representative Stevenson.
Good morning.
Good morning. All right. Where are we moving this? Labor. All right. So I will move House File 3488 be referred to the Committee on Labor. And I understand we have an amendment. Would you like to do the amendment first? All right. Representative Stevenson, if you can briefly explain the amendment, we'll get that taken care of.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment incorporates some technical advice we received from the Department of Labor. It does introduce a new concept allowing young people to delete the content that bears their image once they reach the age of 13. And I will note that that concept probably needs a little more refining, and we'll do that in the next committee stop. And we're committed to working with stakeholders to get that language exactly right.
All right. You know, I believe in the committee process. That's why we do this, so we
yep.
can make the bill better. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Representative Niska.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Stevenson, I was I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about the technical advice you got from the department. And in particular, I think it seems like there's actually a substantive choice here to take enforcement of this provision out of the normal DALI process and only put it into the potentially like a kid suing their parents or something like that as the only enforcement mechanism for this. So I was hoping you could speak to that a little bit about whether that's is that what's intended and is that and maybe explain why that would be the right way to do this.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. That's actually, you said exactly what I would have said, which is that the intention is to clarify that we're not creating a mechanism for which the Department of Labor is going to enforce this bill. This is intended to be a privately enforced action. This bill, as I will mention in my remarks, is based on language that has passed in the state of Illinois and as well as several other states, which is in turn based on a model in California that's been in place for several decades, and that's how it's worked in all of those jurisdictions as being a private right of action, not a department enforced. And the original bill wasn't enforced by the department. It just was in a section of statute that kind of suggested maybe it could be. And so we're moving it into a different section of statute to add clarity that it's not being enforced by the Department of Labor.
Right. Any follow-up, Representative Niska?
Just a couple of comments, which is I guess I'm open-minded about that. It does make me a little worried that we're talking about just only the only way that this is taken care of is if a kid sues their parents, probably, in a lot of situations. Just a comment on the other provision, maybe as it's moving along, it could be moved in a different place with a different heading or something, just the way it's placed right now. Is a little confusing. It's in the middle of a provision about trusts for minors or something like that. So just a thought.
All right. Any other discussion to the A1? All right. I can't remember if I actually moved the A1, so I will move the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Stevenson, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill relates to children who are working as social media influencers. Many of you are probably not entirely familiar with this concept, so let me read you the story of a young person named Samia, as told by the New York Times. Samia was an influencer before she could talk. Her parents, Adam and Latoya, are influencers themselves and began chronicling Samia's impending arrival on YouTube and Instagram in 2014 once they learned that they were pregnant. Samia's birth video is on YouTube, so she's pretty much been born into social media, said her mother. Samia is now 4 and has 134,000 followers on Instagram and 203,000 subscribers on YouTube. Her feeds are mostly populated with posts of her posing and playing, but they also feature paid promotions for brands like Crayola and Homestyle Harvest Chicken Nuggets. Members, this can be big money. The Washington Post estimated that momfluencing is a $1 billion industry nationwide. Kyle Fisher, the father of 2-year-old identical twins who have more than 2 million followers on Instagram, said a sponsored post, just one post on his girl's account, fetches between $10,000 and $20,000. This industry also has a very dark side. A Utah influencer named Ruby Frankie was charged with multiple counts of aggravated child abuse as her 12-year-old son showed up at a neighbor's home, malnourished and with open wounds. Frankie's YouTube channel documented the lives of her 6 kids had over 2 million subscribers. Frankie's channel advocated for severe punishment, going without food, intense manual labor, and other extreme and odd punishments. One child reported being forced to sleep on a beanbag for months as a punishment. Frankie has pled guilty and is going to prison. Her YouTube channel was generating an estimated $1,000 every week. NBC reported on the story of one child influencer. Cam said that their mother began posing photos and videos of them on MySpace when they were in the 2nd grade. They didn't comprehend how many people were watching them growing up, Cam said, until their mother joined Facebook. Cam assumed that their mother knew her thousands of friends personally, so they often accepted requests from random adults because their mother was a mutual friend. As a result, they'd sometimes receive disturbing messages. quote, "I remember I was 12 years old and I was riding my bike with my friends around the town that we lived in at the time and getting a Facebook message the day after saying, 'Hey, I saw you riding your bike,' Cam said. And it was from an older man and it was just very uncomfortable." Cam, who is immunocompromised, said that throughout their childhood they were repeatedly hospitalized for a myriad health issues. Every time Cam had a new medical scare, they said their mother would immediately post about it on Facebook and people in Cam's real life would ask about it. "It felt so invasive because I didn't tell anyone about my health situation, and obviously it was all coming from what my mother was posting." Or consider the phenomena of mommy-run accounts. These are social media accounts purportedly for young kids, but actually run by their parents. Some of these accounts feature scantily clad pictures of teens and preteen girls. Some of these accounts offer access to even more content behind a paywall. This bill does two things. It gives kids the right to demand the permanent deletion of images and videos bearing their likeness once they reach the age of 13. I picked age 13 because that's when most platforms allow people to have accounts under federal privacy law. And so it seems like if you're allowed to post things online, you should be allowed to demand that images of you be taken down from the internet. It also requires a certain percent of the money generated from this influence activity to be set aside for the children's benefit in the trust that they can access once they reach adulthood. If that model sounds familiar, as I mentioned to Representative Niska, it's because it's actually been in place for TV and Hollywood child actors for over seven decades in the state of California due to some pretty notable cases of kids who were working as child actors, and then when they reached adult, they had their nothing. The parents and managers had taken all the money. Illinois has passed a similar law in the last year to this one for social media influencers, and similar legislation is pending in six other states this year. And I do want to just be clear that this bill doesn't, I don't think, fully address the problem of these kid influencing accounts, particularly those mommy run accounts that I was talking about. You know, I think I had a great conversation with Representative Scott on the floor yesterday about this issue, and I've talked to Chair Becker Finn and others about this issue, and I'll just say anyone who's got an idea for how we can better regulate and put guardrails on this, I would be very interested in talking to you. You know, I think that we do already have laws against, of course, child pornography, child abuse, child neglect, but this is a new phenomena that we really need to take seriously. It's doing actual harm to real people, and we need to take it seriously. So thank you, Madam Chair. I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. First, I didn't have any testifiers signed up, but I will ask if there is anyone from the public wishing to testify on this bill. All right. Now we can move on to questions. Members, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, so it seems really clear how this works if the child is like the toy opener and it's like they're the focus. Does this also protect when it's like a family and they have children in their videos, they might not be the focus? Could a child that just occasionally is in videos then like assert rights under this? I'm just curious like how far the protection goes.
Representative Stevenson.
I think what the bill contemplates is if the child's likeness is used in the post, then it counts towards the various protections in the bill in terms of the amount of, in order to trigger the bill, you have to be in a certain percentage of the content that's generating income, and then the amount of income that's set aside depends on how much of the content the child is featured in. So, you know, just being in one post on the side probably is not enough to trigger the bill. It'd have to be an ongoing thing, and then I think the percentage is 30% to be inside the bill, and then there's a how much income you get just depends on how much you're in the posts.
Representative Feist, any follow-up? All right. Representative Finke.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, and my apologies for my tardiness. Thank you for bringing this bill, Representative Stevenson. It's an important bill. My question is actually close to or adjacent to Representative Feist's question. A lot of these, I have children of the YouTube consuming age. They are not allowed to be on the internet in any way, shape, or form. We have unique jobs here, and I would never allow for that. But I know that some of these have large families. A lot of these accounts are about the large family phenomenon of people making television shows or YouTube shows, and I'm just curious if we have 30% of the content creators compensated video content produced includes the likeness, name, or photograph of the minor. If we can sort of think about expanding that to make sure it's not, well, one of my seven kids is only in it for 9%, and then the other one of my seven kids is in it for 14%, and then you avoid the law. That would be a suggestion I would put forward.
Yeah, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Finke. And you're right. A lot of these cases, influencers do have larger families, and so that's an interesting idea about trying to make sure that you can't game the system by only putting one kid in post so often to make sure that they don't trigger the 30% threshold. So I think that is something I'd be interested in thinking about and looking at. Thanks for raising it.
Yeah, any follow-up?
Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And those people have asked some really good questions on this topic. It's, in fact, we had some friends over to watch the Kansas City Chiefs win the Super Bowl. And anyway, they had their kind of teenage and preteen kids with them, and I learned a whole new vocabulary on what goes on this influencing piece, and learned some new terminology. But thank you for the conversation yesterday, Representative Stevenson, and to research. I was going to try to offer an amendment that addressed, you know, sexual content and not being able, these parents that are exploiting their own children is there should be a special punishment for them. And so, but the devil's in the details, as we've discovered. It's not an easy thing to parse out with definitions and the First Amendment and all these things. So I look forward to, you know, exploring different avenues on this to tighten this up so that we can make sure that especially parents that are exploiting their own kids are held accountable. And I think it's just unacceptable. And I would guess that everybody around this table agrees. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you for the comment. And I'll say, you know, kind of like many of the things we deal with in this committee, you know, sort of like balancing the freedom of expression versus the right to privacy. And, you know, we our rights as parents, but also, you know, ultimately these are not consenting adults to have their likenesses and their images out there for public consumption. I know I've had the phenomena of being out at the Science Museum and seeing some kid I have never met in real life and recognizing immediately who that kid is because of their parent posting pictures of them. And that happened. And it made me realize and made me more careful about posting my own children's pictures, even on Facebook. You know, Facebook has been around so long, you might have like 800 friends. That's a lot of people who have access to images of your kids. So it's a good topic for us to delve into. Any other comments or questions from the committee? All right, closing comments, Representative Stevenson. Plenty of time to get to session.
That's great. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the conversation today. I appreciate the feedback. We'll work on that as we go to the next committee. The only thing that I'll add is we did last year give the Attorney General some funds to do a report on social media's impact on young people, with particular emphasis on young people's mental health. That report came out on the 1st of February, and it made policy recommendations to the legislature. If you haven't had a chance to review that, I strongly encourage you to take a look, and if you're interested, let me know, and I will make sure you get a copy.
I just asked our CA to email that out to the committee, so we've all got it in our email. So. Anything else, Representative Stevenson?
Nothing further.
All right. I will renew my motion that House File 3488, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Labor. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. We'll be back next week. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.